Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Okay, great. This afternoon we are looking at the parables. Last week we looked at the big story of Scripture and thought about what is the whole story of Scripture, and we looked at it through the lens of creation, fall, redemption, restoration. God made a perfect creation in which everything was good, that fell apart, and the rest of the story is essentially the answer to that problem as Jesus comes to restore this world. And we looked at that, and we particularly looked at the theme of the kingdom last week, and we thought about what people were expecting by the kingdom, what particular groups would have made if Jesus claimed that the kingdom was here, and therefore what they would have made of the things that Jesus said. Would they have liked it? Would they have been pro certain things he said? Would there have been certain things that they wish he'd emphasized more or got angry with, and those sorts of things? And so that was the big picture. That was the big story of the kingdom running throughout all of Scripture. And today we're going to take it down to a slightly smaller level, and we're going to think about the little stories that Jesus told, the parables, which were powerful and challenging stories that he told, which seemed to annoy many people. There are plenty of notes down here. Just chuck them around. So he told these stories which seemed to annoy certain people and excite others. And I don't know if you find the parables easy to read or hard to read, but it'd be worth, before we get into them, actually just talking about that a little bit. What do you make of the parables? Do you look at them and you're like, love these stories, or do you feel like, I have no idea what to do with these? Be honest. Have you ever read a parable? Okay, yeah, great. They're in the Gospels, New Testament. Jesus said them. Little stories. What do you think of them?
I look at them as figurative expressions.
Figurative expressions of...
get into the main point that you want them to break down by themselves.
Yep. So that's important, actually. That wasn't something I was even going to say, but they're not actually true stories, necessarily. I mean, they may be based on true stories, but they're stories that Jesus told. They're like preaching illustrations to some extent, although we'll unpack that in a minute. But they were to get to a particular point, and they're figurative. Yeah. Great.
But on the surface, they're accessible.
Mm.
But, you know, it's not some theology that you have to understand all the terms. It's just a story that anyone can engage with.
Yeah. Yeah, so they are kind of accessible, aren't they? And people can engage with them. What makes them easy to engage with?
Yeah, relatable.
Are they relatable to us?
Like the context, the cultural context of the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thinking that the Jew or the Greek would have understood that.
Yes.
The world would have understood.
Yeah, they're very understandable to people in their day, yeah. And partly because Jesus just sort of picked things that they did all the time. So he talks about farming, and he talks about things that they're really familiar with. And so it brings it right down to an accessible level. Yeah, yeah. Do we find them easy, therefore, to understand? No, okay, so they're accessible, and yet one person over here doesn't find them easy to understand. Does anyone else sometimes find them hard to understand? That's okay. I do. In fact, I was saying earlier, there are some parables I'm really desperately hoping people won't today go, but what about this one? I'm not going to tell you which ones they are, but there are a couple. I'm like, still don't know what to do with those. They are complex at times, and sometimes hard to understand, and then actually even once you feel like you've understood them, to apply them is difficult as well. So they are challenging. Well, let's launch into them and let's have a look. And what I want to do first of all is show you one particular approach to interpreting the parables, and this I think will set up much of the other stuff that I want to look at today. So, without turning over the page in your notes, the parable of the... I've forgotten which story I'm starting with, actually. Yeah, the parable of the Good Samaritan. Let's start with that one. Without looking at your notes, without looking at a Bible passage, can someone tell me roughly the story of the Good Samaritan? I'm just looking for the story. I'm not looking for, like, and it means this and it means this. Just the story as Jesus told it.
A wealthy Jewish man was on the road in Samaria, and he was robbed by who, I can't remember who, and the Samaritan came along and saw his desperation and was kind to him and helped him on his way and gave him material.
Great, okay, that's the general gist of the story. Can anyone fill in any other details that John might have missed there?
Yeah, the people that were actually meant to help him,
yes.
avoided him.
Yep. And who were those people? More than that? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So priests. Yeah. And they, sorry, I cut you off, but they ignored him. That's what you're saying. Yeah. Great. What did the Samaritan do? He took him to an inn. Yeah. And did he just dump him there? Yeah, so he, brilliant, so he paid for him and he said, if there's any more, on the, when I come back, I'll settle the bill. And yeah, okay, that's a lot of the story. Great. Okay, now what I want to do is read you, and you can turn over the page if you like, I'm going to read you an interpretation of this parable by Augustine, who is one of the famous church fathers, and I've given you a chart which sort of corresponds to what I'm going to read, but this is Augustine's take on the parable of the Good Samaritan. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Adam himself is meant. Okay, so he thinks that this man who walked down from Jerusalem to Jericho represents Adam. Jerusalem is the heavenly city of peace from whose blessedness Adam fell. Jericho means the moon and signifies all mortality because it is born, waxes, wanes, and dies. Thieves are the devil and his angels who stripped him, namely of his immortality, and beat him by persuading him to sin and left him half dead because insofar as a man can understand and know God, he lives, but insofar as he is wasted and oppressed by sin, he is dead. So when he talks about being half dead, it means he is spiritually dead because of sin, but half alive because there's some remnant of the knowledge of God in him, according to Augustine. Therefore, he is called half dead. The priest and the Levite who saw him and passed by signify the priesthood and ministry of the Old Testament, which could profit nothing for salvation. Samaritan means guardian, and therefore the Lord himself is signified by this name. So the Good Samaritan is God himself, according to Augustine, or Jesus in particular. The being set upon the beast is belief in the incarnation of Christ. The inn represents the church, where travellers returning to their heavenly country are refreshed after pilgrimage. The morrow, the next day that is after the resurrection of the Lord. The two pence are either the two precepts of love or the promise of this life and of that which is to come. The innkeeper is the Apostle Paul. The payment is either his counsel of celibacy or the fact that he worked with his own hands lest he should be a burden to any of the weaker brethren when the gospel was new, though it was lawful for him to live by the gospel. So this is Augustine's take of the parable of the Good Samaritan. You can see it on your table, everything that represents something in this parable. What do you make of it? Do you find that convincing? Do you think that's what Jesus was trying to say? If so, why? If not, why not? And I'm afraid my facial expressions have given the game away here already. are you convinced by his reading of the parable of the Good Samaritan? No. Okay. Anyone convinced by it? No. Good. and any particular reasons why you don't think that's a good take on the parable of the Good Samaritan?
It's almost like looking too much into it.
Okay. Looking too much into it. Yeah. Everything has to represent something else, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the inn can't simply be an inn. You know, he took him to an inn. Yeah, exactly.
It also takes away, I guess, the responsibility from the reader to kind of put it into a spiritual sense, right? Actually, sort of practical element to it.
Okay, so it makes it really spiritual rather than actually looking at the practical purpose of the parable, which, actually, we'll come back to what the practical purpose of the parable was in a second, but yeah, interesting point, yeah. And actually, by making it so spiritual, it almost makes it less accessible in a weird kind of way. Because, like, I read it and I don't think, "Oh, Jericho represents the moon," and so therefore I can think, "What an idiot I am," because I didn't have Augustine to tell me that. But yeah.
That's what I was going to say. It defeats the object of being accessible for the masses when it's this slow.
Yeah. 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 No. Absolutely. Sorry, I said it before you did. But sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, because I was looking at it.
Was the Good Samaritan Christ? Yeah, interesting. Does anyone naturally read the parable of the Good Samaritan and think, oh yeah, this represents Jesus?
I think it might have its qualities, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's a natural reading of it, actually, but yeah. I mean, I think often we read the parables and we say, oh, a good person, I know a good person, that must be Jesus. whereas it might not actually be. And is there anything that would make you think that that is that. I mean, to be fair, I haven't actually let you read the passage. We've only told the story, but it doesn't take into account the context. Yeah. So actually, why does Jesus tell the parable of the Good Samaritan? Because someone comes to him and says, teacher, who is my neighbour? And so Jesus says, let me tell you a story about that. And then at the end, Jesus says, go and do likewise. So what is the practical application of it? Be the Good Samaritan. Yeah, be like the Good Samaritan. And actually, I won't go there, but some people have disputed that recently, but I think they're wrong. So, the context is fairly clear. Who is my neighbour? Jesus says, I'll tell you a story. And then he gets to the end and says, go and do likewise. And there seems to be a reason for him telling the story, which Augustine seems to ignore. Any other things that make it problematic as a reading of the parable of the Good Samaritan? A couple of really obvious ones that you'll kick yourself when we say them.
To me, it seems crazy to suppose the Good Samaritan was Christ because the Jews hated the Samaritans.
Okay.
So, yeah. That just seems like they wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Well, that's the tricky thing, isn't it? Because you start off by saying, surely Jesus wouldn't call himself a Samaritan, because that would be an awful thing, and people would have thought badly. Oh, actually, people did think badly of Jesus. So it's exactly the kind of thing he might have done, although I don't think he has. So you're right. It's culturally an odd one, isn't it? Some really obvious ones. The inn represents the church. Did the church exist when Jesus told this story? Not really. Not in the way that we think of it today, and certainly not in the way that Augustine was thinking about it. Was there a group known as the ecclesia, the people of God, the kahal of God? Yes, that all the way through the Old Testament, people were known as the kahal, the gathered people of God, and then the New Testament word ecclesia was used of that group of people, and that was the word that became church. So you could say, yes, the church existed, but not in the format that Augustine is probably thinking of. Boom, there we go. No Apostle Paul. So, yeah, no Apostle Paul. So I mean, obviously, Jesus hears the voice of God, very prophetic, said lots of stuff that came to pass in generations. But are we really meant to think that he was talking about the Apostle Paul here? And were his original readers thinking, oh yes, he's talking about some guy who we've not yet seen, maybe Paul, who's, you know, no. Or they would have sat there and thought, I've no idea what you're talking about, Jesus. And he goes, ha-ha, you will do in 30 years, or whatever. You know, that's not the Jesus I know, really, although if I were Jesus, I might have done that. But I don't think so. It just doesn't make sense. I think this is a fairly laughable approach to the parable of the Good Samaritan. And to be fair, I have taken one of the most ludicrous examples, so this is quite extreme, but it does represent a particular approach to the parables, which I think is quite unhelpful. And you read lots of stuff and you just think, man, I think you've utterly missed the point of the parable. Surely it cannot mean that. But then, if I'm honest, I've also heard plenty of preaching on the parables and in churches like ours, and probably in our church as well, and thought, I'm not sure we always get it much better either, because there is so much in the parables that's culturally relevant to those days that you think, I don't know how to apply this now, or I can read it on a surface level, but actually there are tensions like the Samaritan tension that you highlighted there that don't immediately leap off the page to me, and so sometimes I feel like we miss the parables as well. So my hope today is just to give us a few new ways of looking at the parables, hopefully give us some tools to know how to interpret them ourselves. We're not going to look at all of them, we won't look at very many of them at all, but I hope that we'll see some stuff today that will help us as we do go and look at them. And some of them are baffling, and there are some of them I look at and I think, if I had to preach that today, I think I could tell you what it means. I'm not sure I'd tell you how to apply it. I just, you know, some of them are really difficult, and this is an area I'd like to do more work on in due course, but this is where I'm at the moment. So turn over to the next page. What are the parables? Well, on one level, they're stories. And as we've said, they are stories designed to get to a particular point and to help people to see something in a new light. Some people say they are earthly stories with a heavenly meaning. You may have heard that sort of definition. I think that's kind of helpful, in so much as it sort of brings God's perspective on natural things. But actually, when we say they're earthly stories with a heavenly meaning, sometimes heavenly sounds like, and we can't really know, which I think is a bit mystical and not really the point of the parables. I think the point is that people should know what they're about, and that they were explosive for many people. People did know what they want, what they're about, and some of them liked that, and some of them really didn't like that. So here are four things that I think are worth bearing in mind when we come to the parables. The first is this: the parables are communicative. This may seem like a silly place to start, but actually I think it's quite helpful. The parables are not simply entertaining stories. They're not like the intro to a sermon before you get into the main kind of content. They are tools of communication. They are deliberately designed to get across a particular point. And so, as a result, their themes are likely to marry up with the themes that were really important to Jesus in his ministry. So Jesus had a particular message that he wanted to communicate, and so chances are the parables are going to somehow fit with that broader message. See what I mean? Are people cold, by the way? I'm noticing a few people looking cold over there. Shall I turn this off? Or? Yes, some people. I'm going to turn it off, and then if it gets warm. I never feel cold. I own one jumper that I wear like once every 5 years or something, so I'm the wrong person to gauge this. So do say if you're cold or hot or whatever. And welcome. So the parables are communicative. They have a particular message that you want to get across, and they are themes that are likely to correspond to the overall themes of Jesus' teaching. C.H. Dodd says, "The parables represent the interpretation which our Lord offered of his own ministry." When we see the parables, it's like Jesus is telling this story that is a representation of the things that matter most to him and explain things that he was here to do and achieve. N.T. Wright says, "They made sense only within the whole context of Jesus' career. They echoed, reflected, interpreted, and indeed defended the main thrusts of Jesus' work, and themselves set up other echoes in turn." See, sometimes we come to the parables and we look at the story and we think, what does that mean? What does that represent? And we forget that actually these were stories that served a purpose within Jesus' larger career. And so if you think, what are the things that Jesus said and did? What was he most passionate about? Chances are those are going to be reflected in the parables. Also, he says, "They echoed, reflected, interpreted, and indeed defended the main thrusts of Jesus' work." I think sometimes you look at things that Jesus did and you kind of don't get the significance of it until you look at the stories he told. And sometimes you read the stories and you think, oh, now I get why Jesus did that particular thing. And we'll come back to that in a moment. And actually, in the first term, when we looked at how to interpret the Gospels, and I got you doing some group work where you looked at three bits that are next to each other. And in some of those cases, Jesus would do something like a miracle, and then he would tell a story, and you think, how on earth are those connected? And then you realize, oh, the story sheds light on why Jesus did the miracle, and vice versa. So I think we should bear that in mind when we come to the parables. Tom Wright again said, he talks about the importance of the kingdom. So the kingdom is central to what Jesus was teaching. And so he says we should expect that the kingdom will be a major theme of the parables. And some people kind of look at the parables and they divide them up and they say, well, here are the parables of the kingdom and here are some others. And they say, well, only the ones that mention the kingdom are about the kingdom. And actually, Tom Wright says, and I think he's correct in this, the story which can be evoked by the phrase "the kingdom of God" may well be present even though the phrase itself is absent. And I'm personally convinced that almost all of the parables are about the kingdom. Some of them use the word kingdom, and some of them just tell a particular story, which if you read it with the knowledge of what the kingdom represents, you think, oh, that one's about the kingdom as well. Almost all of the parables, if not all of them, are something to do with Jesus' central message of the kingdom of God, which, as we saw last week, is not just a geographical thing, but it means coming under the rule of God and experiencing all the blessing that comes with that. And yes, you need to live a particular way. Yes, you need to respond in a particular way. But if you live under the king dominion of God, as some people describe it, if you live under his rule, this is what life will be like. And I think Jesus is unpacking that through the parables, even when he doesn't actually use the word kingdom. So parables, first of all, are communicative. Secondly, they are cultural. And by that I mean there are things in them that are simply not true of our culture, and we shouldn't get het up on them. So I remember reading I was doing a bit of work for my MA in theology, and I was reading this paper that was like about 6,000 words long, and this guy was arguing that Jesus got it wrong when he said that the mustard seed is the smallest of all seeds, because we now know that there are smaller seeds. And I was like, what a colossal waste of ink. Jesus was not saying, this is the smallest seed there is now and forever will be. And if Jesus said to his hearers, this is the seventh smallest seed, and people said, well, what do you mean? Name the other six. And Jesus said, well, I can't because they exist in another part of the world that you've not yet traveled to. That would be utterly ludicrous to his hearers. Jesus was not saying things that would always be... No, hang on. He was saying things that would always be true, but when he's making cultural references, I think we need to understand them in their culture. So when Jesus said the mustard seed is the smallest of all, he's talking about what people knew at that point in time. Let me give you another example. The story of the parable of the sower. Have you ever read this story and just thought, this sower is pretty useless, to be honest? He doesn't seem to know what he's doing. Actually, if you read it through Western modern ideas, the parable does seem like the guy doesn't know what he is talking about. Jeremias, who's written a brilliant, if a little dated, book on the parables, he says this, that he writes, a man scatters seed so liberally that it ends up going among the thorns and on the path, which is pointless and wasteful. Surely, as any modern farmer would tell you, you plough the field and you scatter the seed on the freshly ploughed soil, not in amongst the weeds. And so a modern hearer of the parable might just think, this guy's doing it all wrong, and may, if they were Augustinian, draw out all sorts of crazy conclusions from that. But he goes on, he says, in Palestine, sowing precedes ploughing. So in the parable, the sower strides over the unploughed stubble, and with this in mind, we comprehend why some seed fell along the path. He sows intentionally on the path, so that the villagers have trodden over the stubble, since he intends to then plough up the path with the rest of the field. He sows intentionally among the thorns, standing withered in the fallow, because they too will be ploughed up. Nor need it surprise us that some grain falls on rocky ground. The underlying limestone, thinly covered with soil, hardly shows above the surface until the ploughshare jars against it. So what he's saying is, in our modern understanding, we plough the ground and then we lay it all down very carefully so we don't waste anything. The way they did it, they would just chuck seed everywhere, liberally, everywhere, knowing this whole lot's going to get ploughed up anyway. That's the way they do it. So he concludes, what seems to the Western mind to be bad farming is simply customary usage in Palestinian conditions. So when we read the parables, we shouldn't expect them to cohere with everything we know today, with modern technology and Western ways of doing things. And if we do think like that, then we will miss the point very often. We need to try, difficult though it is, to get into the mindset of the original hearers and understand the cultural things for what they are. Any questions on that? Great. Thirdly, the parables are confrontational. Matthew 21. At the end of this parable, it says, when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard this parable, they perceived he was talking about them, and although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowds. So these people, the chief priests, they hear this parable, and they think, this guy is talking about us. We don't like that. And this is more cause for us to want to arrest him. And yet they couldn't, because they feared the crowds. But the point is, they heard that, and they thought, this guy is calling us out. We've got to do something about this. And what they were planning to do was arrest him and kill him. These were parables that were going to get Jesus in trouble. They are confrontational parables. And people understood them that way. Jeremiah says this, for the most part, though not exclusively, they are weapons of controversy. Every one of them calls for an answer on the spot. All of the parables that deal with the gospel itself are a defense of the good news. The actual proclamation of the good news to sinners took a different form in the offer of forgiveness. In Jesus inviting the guilty to taste his hospitality and in calling them to follow him. It was not to sinners that he addressed the gospel parables, but to his critics and those who rejected him because he gathered the despised around him. It's a slightly generalized saying, but what he's essentially saying is when Jesus interacted with people who were lowly, who were open to the message, who were classed as sinners, he very often did so through demonstrations of grace and love and acceptance and welcoming in. And some of his harshest parables are actually directed to the others who would keep the sinners out. And Jesus says these parables, and as Jeremiah says, it immediately just calls for a response. Sometimes it's a response of you need to change. You need to change your mind and get with the program because currently you think you're in and you're out. And Jesus would say things that would shock people. He would say things that, we'll come to this in a moment, that would be like familiar stories that people would listen to and enjoy and then suddenly get to the end and go, hang on, you said what? I'm what? You're confronting me? So Jesus would tell these stories and suck people in and then there'd just be this kick at the end that would confront people. I don't know if you've ever read stories to children, and it's like a favourite story that they have had. Sometimes you tell this story, and parents tell me they just get so bored of it. And I don't have kids yet. I get bored even reading a kid's story once, twice. I had to read one the other day. It made no sense at all. But there you go. That's a distraction. But yeah, it was rubbish. But anyway, you tell these stories, and sometimes the kids get so familiar with the stories, they absolutely love the stories. Now, if you were to be a bit cheeky or bored or whatever, and decide just to change one item of the story, the kid would go crazy. So you're kind of telling the story about whatever it is, this kid that goes to pick up flowers from the, I don't know, whatever. And if you just change a little bit of the story, this kid who's heard the story like dozens and dozens and dozens of times before and doesn't get bored of it would suddenly go, hang on, that's not how the story goes. if they can speak, that is. And they would just go, hey, that's not right. Because they understand the way the story flows. And so if you flow in a familiar story and then suddenly you just change it, it's going to cause people problems. In the same sort of way, many of the parables that Jesus is telling are familiar stories. They are stories that people would have understood. They would have known how the story goes and thought, oh yeah, I've heard this one before. And this person represents this person. And this person represents me. And then suddenly Jesus would just change a detail and you think, oh, hang on, I thought I was that person, but you're saying I'm that person. But that person gets punished. So, wow, what are you doing here, Jesus? And we'll see that when we get to the end of this session, how Jesus just plays it like a switcheroo, and suddenly you think you're the good guy, and Jesus is saying you're not. They were confrontational, hence people heard his stories and wanted to kill him. That was quite a dangerous thing to do. And when we read them as just nice little illustrative ideas about how we should pray more or whatever, I think we miss some of the point. They're confrontational stories. And fourthly, they are cryptic stories. And this is slightly confusing, but let me get a couple of people to read some passages. Could one person read to me, not to me, for me, to the group, Matthew 13, verses 1 to 17, and then 34 to 35. And then could someone else get Mark 4 ready to read as well? Can I have a volunteer for the Matthew passage? Matthew 13, verses 1 to 17, and then 34 to 35. Fantastic. Sorry, I gave you a rather long stretch there, but well done. And then verses 34 to 35, I'll tell you what, I'll read them so I'm not inflicting more upon you. He goes on and he carries on, and this is essentially a continuation after he's told a few more parables. He says, all these things Jesus said to the crowd in parables. Indeed, he said nothing to them without a parable. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter what has been hidden since the foundation of the world. So Jesus tells all these parables, and then in amongst it, the disciples say, what are you speaking parables? And Jesus gives this slightly rambling answer. And essentially what he is saying is, I tell these, let's find it, what did he say? I tell these so that you will hear and not understand, which is slightly baffling. So Jesus tells these stories in order that people will not understand. Now someone, can you read to me Mark 4 and verses 11 to 12?
He replied, you are permitted to understand the secret of the kingdom of God, but I use parables for everything I say to outsiders, so that the scriptures might be fulfilled. When they see what I do, they will learn nothing. When they hear what I say, they will not understand it. Otherwise, they will turn to me.
So it seems there that Jesus is actually saying, again, I speak and I give you, speaking to the disciples, I give you the ability to see into these things, to understand things of the kingdom, but actually I speak to outsiders so that they will not understand. And Jesus seems to be deliberately telling stories that will confuse people, that will stop them from grasping the point. And actually, if you were to read even further on, Mark 4, verse 33, he continues, he tells some more parables. He says, with many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. So even in Mark's chapter there, in one chapter, Jesus seems to say, I say these things so that people won't understand and it will confuse them. and then he says, he told them in parables so that they were able to hear it, as they were able to hear it, in a manner that they would be able to understand. So it seems to be some kind of weird contradiction going on there. Why did Jesus tell these parables in a particular way? Anyone have any thoughts or answers? Was he trying to confuse people? Was he trying to make them accessible to people?
It almost kind of just fits in with a lot of the mysticism, if that's a word, or kind of the mysterious nature of God himself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes challenges you, or sometimes just deters you, or sometimes draws you in. It's almost just poetic of that.
Yeah.
It's kind of just another way of trying to symbolise just how sometimes you just can't understand.
Yes.
Whilst trying to at the same time.
Yes.
So
in some sense, because it's mysterious, it causes people to think, I want to understand this, and then sometimes it reinforces the fact that you don't understand it, if you see what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's another kind of element going on there, and we won't look at it, but if you were to look at Isaiah 6 and read some of the passages that Jesus quotes there, Jesus quotes quotes Isaiah saying, I speak to these people so that they won't understand, and it's like they'll be confirmed in their hardness of heart, I suppose. So sometimes Jesus tells these stories, and when people reject the stories, it's like that's a proof of the fact that essentially they've rejected God. And in rejecting the stories that Jesus tells, it's like their hearts get harder. So when Jesus tells these stories, I think they have a strange ability to reveal the truth of the heart of the listener, if I can put it like that. To the person with an already hard heart, the parables reinforce that hardness of heart. And they think, I can't understand what he's talking about. And so they reject him. To the people with open hearts who are willing to be challenged and brought through to new life, the parables help them to see things in a new light. So Craig Blombird says, the parables not only conceal, but they also reveal. And they often reveal which was previously concealed. So they have a dual function. Sometimes the parables just make people go, oh, wow, I'd never seen that before. Sometimes people make them think, what is Jesus talking about? And they go away feeling harder of heart than they previously did. The parables have this amazing ability through one story just to draw life out of some people and confirm death in others, if I can put it like that. To open up some people's hearts and close up other people's hearts within one story, which is quite incredible. So the parables are cryptic, but they are powerfully cryptic. So four thoughts about parables, things that we should look out for that I think define the parables. Let me give you a couple of approaches for interpreting the parables on the next page, and then we'll actually get to it and we'll look at a couple. And just a tiny bit of history, really. At the beginning, we looked at Augustine's approach, which is known as an allegorical approach. So it's an approach to the parables which treats every little detail as if it means something. So this rock represents whatever, this the fact that there were two pence means that there are two things represented. This one's this and this one's something else. And the allegorical approach reads so much into every detail of a story. And Augustine is one representative of that approach, but actually it was quite a big approach. And for hundreds of years, this was the way that people read the parables, thinking that everything referred to something. A very, very popular approach. However, I think because it's quite vague, really. I mean, Augustine just decided that the moon represented this, or Jericho represented the moon, which represented our mortality. And someone else might read it and think, no, well, it represents something, but it doesn't represent that. And so you get this huge variance of people just reading it however they want to, however they hear it. And so with the allegorical approach, you get loads and loads of different approaches to the parables, and it's hard to know which one is right. Which one did Jesus actually mean? It often means as well that these parables preach well, because you can go, and this one represents this, and people go, wow, I hadn't seen that before, and this one represents this, and we're like, wow, this guy is so incredible. But often it actually makes no sense of its original context, because we hear it today and think, wow, I didn't realize that that represented that and that represented that. And if you actually spoke to someone who heard it in the original context, they would have been like, no, it didn't, it was just about a man plowing a field. Because we kind of divorce them from their original context by making it also spiritual, as we talked about earlier. So the allegorical approach was popular for many, many hundreds of years. And then a guy came along called Adolf Jülicher, who wrote a seminal book that kind of just critiqued that and essentially killed off the allegorical approach, for which I'm very grateful. But what he didn't do is propose an alternative that was much better. And so two writers then came along a little bit later, known as Joachim Jeremias and C.H. Dodd, and they wrote two books which are brilliant on the parables. Pretty dated now, and Jeremiah's one I think is slightly better than Dodd's, but they're very good. But essentially what they said is, we need to get rid of the allegorical approach. We're glad that Jülicher has done that for us, but the answer is that we need to really see them as situational stories. They were told in a particular point in time, in a particular place in time. Jesus said things in particular settings. There is a clear historical reason for every parable. And so Jeremiah says this: each of Jesus' parables has a definite historical setting, and to recover that setting is the task before us. What did Jesus intend to say at this or at that particular moment? And so they did a lot of work in thinking about, why did Jesus tell this story? How can we reconstruct the scenario and think about what the place was like where Jesus told this story, and therefore what the story might mean? And they did some amazing work, because it really helps you to understand the parables in their original context. And I'm really grateful for them. And I found their work really eye-opening. However, there were two main problems with their work. One was that when you read the parables, you do sometimes think, well, that is a little bit allegorical, and things do represent something else. And what they said, Dodd particularly said, well, the reason there are allegorical things in there is because the church has taken the stories and added things into them over time, which I don't think is a very good answer at all. I happen to think that Jesus was good enough at telling stories that they're probably his own stories. So that's one of the things that I don't find very helpful. The second thing is that they so located it in one particular point in time that sometimes you read their interpretations of the parables and you think, so does this have any relevance to anyone but these five people who heard this story? And sometimes you read them and you think, there's no lasting relevance to them. So what many people do now is they kind of blend the two approaches, and their kingdom approach is not really the best term, but it's one that people sometimes use. They say, actually, there are allegorical elements in the stories, but they're also original setting that have to be recovered. And so the way to read the parables is to think, what is the original reason why Jesus told this? What would his original hearers have heard? Where would they have been located? What was the culture like? Etc., etc., etc. But also be open to the idea of spiritual meanings and those sorts of things. And together, I think, by taking those two strands of scholarship, we can have an approach to the parables which I think is rounded, and which means that there is not only a way of understanding what the original hearers would have meant, but how we can apply it to our lives today. So four suggestions for what we should look for when interpreting the parables, and then we will actually do some of it. Firstly, I think we should look for one main point, and we've kind of touched on this anyway. With the allegorical approach, it's like there's tons of stuff and tons of meanings. Actually, I think often there's one main point that Jesus is trying to make in very simple language, and we make it too confusing. So R.T. Kendall, in his book on the parables, he says, often a parable will only have one basic truth in mind. We must not try to read more into a parable than we ought. We must never try to make a parable stand on all four legs, he says. Not every detail of a parable has to have a meaning. I think that's very helpful. There is often one main point, and often, as I've said before, the one main point is about the kingdom. They're fairly straightforward in that regard. But secondly, we should look at the wider setting. So as we've already touched on, we should ask, before we think, what's this parable telling us? We should say, why did Jesus tell the parable? Look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. Why does it start? It's because a guy comes to him and says, Jesus, who's my neighbor? That immediately gives you a clue what kind of story you're about to read. Look at the ends of the parables. The before and after of the parables are hugely helpful because it often tells us why Jesus started the story and then what people made of the story, how people interpreted the story. So look at the before and after. Also look at what is around it. Are there other parables? Are there miracles? Is there a reason why Jesus told this parable and then did this miracle? Do they interpret one another? And we touched on some of that last time. Thirdly, look at its place in Jesus' wider ministry. So how does it fit with the other main themes of Jesus' ministry, in particular the kingdom? And fourthly, look at the use of imagery from the Old Testament. I think there are plenty of allegorical elements in the parables, and when we look at them in a moment, we'll see that things do represent other things. But sometimes you can look at them and think, man, I'm a bit clueless to know what that represents. And so you can sort of go down the Augustine route, but often you just think, I don't know. I have no idea where to start. How do I know what the moon represents or the inn represents? Well, the way to know is to look at how that particular metaphor is used throughout all of Scripture. And when Jesus is using particular metaphors, very often they are metaphors that are rooted in the Old Testament. So when Jesus talks about vines or the sun, or stones, or fields, or vineyards, or these sorts of things. These are rich metaphors that have a history. And people would have heard that and thought, I know what he's talking about because they knew their Old Testament. So if you are looking at it and you're thinking, I don't know what the vine represents there, why not turn to a concordance and look up the vine in the Old Testament or follow it through and you think, the vine often represents Israel or represents whatever, and therefore you come back to the parables and you're not just plucking it out of thin air or turning to Augustine's little handbook for help. You are turning to the scriptures that Jesus was himself basing his stories in. So when you're looking for allegorical elements, look at the Old Testament. Also ask your question, does this story sound familiar? When you read the parable, think, have I heard anything like that elsewhere? And again, I'm really meaning the Old Testament. And you'll find that very often you have, because Jesus is retelling stories in a way to really help you to rethink them. Okay, that's a lot of theory I've just thrown at you without actually looking at many parables at all. So any questions on that, or shall we just get into some parables? Yeah, go for it. Understanding what some of these words mean and there are some great Bible dictionaries which will be helpful. Most of them are pretty huge, which is a problem. I can't remember the name of the one that I often use, so I'll have to look it up and let you know. But yeah, there are plenty of Bible dictionaries that are worth checking out. Yes, or just a good study Bible will often do it. So I use the ESV study Bible, and very often in the notes it will say, you know, see this thing on the vine or whatever, and that's quite helpful. But I'll look up the name of the book that I use and let you know it's quite helpful. All right, let's look at some parables. So turn over to the next page. What I'd like to do is to break us into three groups. Okay, let's go for, okay, I'll tell you what, how about let's go for you three rows together, and you can be group one, if you would mind coming over this side, and we'll go for, yeah, you and these front two rows, and you can be group two, and then if you back two rows can be group three, that'll be great. So if you look on page, whatever it is, it's the one with three boxes, I've assigned three parables. So Guys at the back, if you could do Matthew 13, 31 to 32. Guys over here, if you can do Matthew 13, verse 33. And then if you guys can do Matthew 13, verse 44, that would be great. And what you'll find is you'll be able to read them really quickly. They're very short parables. And in the bottom box, you'll find a couple of hints. So these are particular passages you might want to look at that I think Jesus is drawing on, or a couple of questions that are worth asking about. And what I want you to think is, what is this passage telling us about the kingdom? What did Jesus mean? And you can get on to what this means to us for today if you like, but I'm primarily wanting you to think, why did Jesus tell this parable and what does it mean? Does that make sense? Great. Go for it. We'll give you 10 minutes and see how you get on. Okay, how did you find that? Easy, hard, fun, depressing?
Difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Cool. How did you guys find it? You ended up talking a lot about baking, which was not my intention, but it's good fun nonetheless. How do you guys find it? Good, good. Okay, well, let's find out how you found it. Let's find out what you think the parables mean. Just one quick observation. All of the parables are from Matthew 13. I probably should have said that earlier, but I think there's a running theme that goes through it, which is the kingdom. And if we had time, we could look at how your parables, which are right next to each other, in fact, we may come to it when we come to your group. Your parables are next to each other. Why are they there? Why are they next to each other? What's the particular reason? Do they help interpret each other? Those are questions worth asking. But let's just start with each parable in turn. So group one, can you tell us, first of all, what the parable was for the other groups that haven't heard it? You may want to read it, actually, and then tell us what you made of it. Just a quick point before you continue. Actually, technically, Jesus has got it wrong. It is not the smallest of all seeds. There are small. No, I'm kidding. Go for it. What do you make of this? What's it about, first of all? It's about the kingdom, isn't it? Because he says that. The kingdom of heaven is like, so we know it's about the kingdom, but then he chooses to use the metaphor of seed. Yeah. Okay, so what is the point that he's trying to draw out with the seed? Yep. Great, okay. First point, very simple. So something very small grows into something bigger. Great, that's what the kingdom's like. Not very encouraging, actually, if you're expecting a big kingdom, like kind of big trumpets and warfare, it starts tiny. That's what Jesus says. Okay? So it's small, it grows. Did you get to look at how... Oh, well, so then at the end, it talks about it being larger than all the garden plants. It becomes a tree. So the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. Did you get to look at what that might represent? Go on, Ian, get spiritual. Well, interesting. So sometimes we can. So actually, I see what you've done there. So because the parable of the sower comes just before, and because I've talked about them. Well, actually, yeah. So the parable of the sower, and then you've got the parable of the weeds. So you do have a lot of farming-related ones in close proximity. So one thing I should say is you need to, when we look at how the metaphors are used, our first way of interpreting it should be, how does Jesus interpret it? And we'll get to this when we look at you guys and the yeast as well. So does Jesus think the birds of the air coming to the kingdom are positive or negative in this parable?
Positive.
Okay. So that tells me, first of all, that it's probably not going to be. He's using the metaphor in a slightly different way. And so here, he's not talking about the birds coming and snatching away, which obviously is a negative thing. He seems to talk about them coming and making nests in the branches, which seems to be more positive, doesn't it? So he probably has something different in mind there.
See, this is kind of the thing. Like, when we just start talking and looking at the verse and talk about like, our perception of it, there's like eight different views on what this parable means.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my fixation, you say, the mustard seed is a metaphor for the church, but I started small, grew into a kind of group, and became rest in place for the nations.
Mm.
Or you could say it's about the kind of spiritual life. You know, it's about, you know, just a small change of kind of perceptions that grows and transforms you.
Yeah.
You something where you can be a way of making up for the rest.
Yeah. Great.
Which is kind of the ultimate problem with the parable.
Exactly, yes.
Like,
so,
story.
Yeah. So if you didn't hear that, the problem is, like, you can look at it and you go, well, this could be about the church, or this could be about the spiritual life, or it could be about... Exactly. And that's what preachers do all the time. It drives me mental. Because you think, you don't have to go there. Why not? Because Jesus tells you what it's about. It's about the kingdom. Yeah, so it's not about the prayer life. It's not about the church. It's about the kingdom. And obviously that has implications for prayer life and that sort of thing. Start with what Jesus said, and it's about the kingdom. So the kingdom is like a tiny seed that goes in the ground. It grows to being a mustard seed, which is the biggest of all garden plants. It comes sort of a tree, and then the birds come. So Jesus is talking about the kingdom here. And it might work as a nice metaphor for a prayer life, but that's not primarily what Jesus is saying here. So then you've got to ask, well, what on earth are the birds bit about? Where did that come from, Jesus? So we gave you some Old Testament passages to draw from. Any particular thoughts on those and what light they may shed? They speak about trees. Yes, yes. That's why I gave you those verses. And what do they say about trees? Trees are good. Yes, okay. Yes. So in Ezekiel... In Ezekiel 31, it talks about these trees. It talks about the cedars of God, which represent Israel, that couldn't rival the giant tree that represents Assyria in Ezekiel. And if you don't know Ezekiel, then that's quite confusing anyway. But actually, these people would be well-versed in these Old Testament passages. They would recognize things. So it seems to be, this picture of trees with these giant nations' trees, and Israel's tree is just small by comparison. And then you get to Daniel, and you have this strange passage in Daniel 4 where Nebuchadnezzar has this dream in which he sees this enormous tree and it stretches into heaven, and the tree gives shelter to many types of bird, and it represents his rule and his kingdom, and he's told that eventually that is going to get torn down. So Nebuchadnezzar has the idea that his kingdom is represented by a giant tree in which all the birds which represent the nations come and find rest. And then Jesus says, the kingdom, my kingdom, it's not like a giant tree, it's like a tiny little mustard seed, goes into the ground. It will grow to be like a tree. But then actually, think about Ezekiel 31, a cedar, and you may not know these about trees, but cedars are enormous things. Mustard tree, like, not very high at all. Even by comparison, it will look pathetic when compared to the nations of the world. Jesus said, that's all right. All the birds of the nations are going to come. All the birds, he says, are going to come and make rest in my tree. What do the birds represent? They represent the nations. So Jesus is saying, mine is a rival kingdom. And it may not look impressive at all. And we looked last week at what people were expecting of the kingdom. And many of them were like, yeah, come on, warfare, we'll take this land, we'll rule everything. And Jesus is like, little seed, little tree, but all the nations will find their rest in it.
Based on the Old Testament.
Hmm.
Yeah. The birds.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. So we've got to, it's not easy, but this is, I think, the way that the original hearers would have heard it. They would have been familiar with stories in which, like Daniel 4, oh, if that tree represents Nebuchadnezzar's nation, which was our enemy, That gets torn down. We get a tree in comparison, but actually it's way smaller, but still the birds which represent the nations come and flock to it. So, great. You were getting there. It was all, you were heading in the right direction. And obviously I've read a lot about this and thought about a lot about this, so don't worry if you didn't get everything that I got. That's totally fine, but you got the main point. Yeah? Cool. Okay, next. Sorry, you have a question on that. Yeah.
Would they have had that head knowledge to be able to relate it to the...
Yeah, fair question. Yes, I think they would have done. So these were people who were well-versed in the Old Testament. They had it drummed into them. They would memorize it. They would tell stories. They were an oral culture, so they would be regularly telling stories. So all this stuff would have been way more ingrained into them culturally than it is to us now. Yeah.
Could you therefore use all that? Could you use the Old Testament? Well, it had to be that, so that's all they knew. So
Yeah, I think what I would say is, first starting point is, what can I tell from the text about Jesus' point? So otherwise you go, seeds, I'll just rush to the Old Testament and find everything about seeds. But whereas if you start off by saying, what does Jesus say? Oh, he says it's about the kingdom, therefore that gives you an immediate grid of reference. So, and you look at why Jesus told the story, how people understood the story, and that should immediately help you. But then once you've got that framework in place, if you look at the pictures and you think, why a stone there, why a seed, why a vine, then I think, yeah, going back to the Old Testament is the way to find out what those things represent in the cultural language of the day. So, yeah. Great, let's move on. I'm keen that we get through this and then that we get to look at one parable together, which I think is arguably Jesus' most challenging and confrontational parable of all. And we'll do that fairly quickly. But so you guys, you were looking at Jesus' recipe for bread by the sounds of your discussion. Can someone read or describe the parable and then give us some thoughts on it? Great. See, that's a good way, isn't it? Yeah. I'll read it, someone else can give the thoughts about it. That's like saying, I'll cook, you wash up. Yeah.
He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough.
Great. What's the parable about, first of all? The kingdom of heaven. How do we know that? Great. Straightforward, isn't it? But it changes. It just stops you running down rabbit warrens. The kingdom of heaven is like, boom. What's his point?
Isn't it similar to that, the parable we just kind of reading before? I don't know, just making think of how it's like, it's kind of small, but then it's potent, and it rises.
Yeah, yeah, very similar.
It seems like that's kind of like it's describing the features of the kingdom of heaven, like the...
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why they're next to each other. They're very similar. And Jesus was okay with repeating himself and telling the same point multiple ways. It starts off very small and it grows. And I think that's his main point. Yeah. R.T. Kendall says this story is about the Holy Spirit bringing change in the life of the Christian. Again, I don't think that is what it's about. Is it a good metaphor for that? Yeah. Is that what it's about? No, I think Jesus is talking about the kingdom. He's saying it starts small and it grows.
But you have this very, very simplistic interpretation of the phrase the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God.
Mm.
Well, I don't know, last week. So
okay, yeah. We did, yeah.
But would people necessarily read this, really, really understand what it means by the kingdom of heaven? Because you could say the kingdom of heaven is a bit more personal thing about your journey to the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
That's
fine. Well, it'll be worth listening back to last week because we looked at that and we looked at what different groups would have made of the phrase the kingdom of heaven. But broadly speaking, the kingdom, the kingdom means the rule of God, and people would have thought that in very concrete terms, like literally us having the rule over this land in which we live as representatives of God. But of course, that affects every area of our lives as well. And so when Jesus talks about the kingdom, you get a sense that he is talking about the way we pray, the way we think, the way we, you know, our spiritual lives, all that sort of stuff is affected by the kingdom. But I think people had a very concrete idea in their mind of what the kingdom was like. And very often it was like, when's God going to come back and rule and we won't have to have these horrible rulers over us anymore? When are we going to get our land back? Or, you know, all that sort of stuff. Hopefully last week the recording from that may help a bit on that. But any particular thoughts about how yeast grows?
Which one was interesting, because we looked, let's say, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 6, and in that context, yeast was seen as something potentially quite negative, like poison. And especially unleavened bread was the bread of the time, wasn't it? That was kind of the traditional bread that they would have in festivals and kind of joyous occasions.
Yeah.
So to put lots of yeast in your bread was not necessarily a good thing. But in the context that Jesus was using it, he was actually challenging that perception of yeast being used in such a way and saying, actually, if it's good and if it's done with kind of a good intention, your inward efforts of doing things will have an outpouring of goodness at the same time, and that's how the kingdom is built.
Yes.
You try and do things within yourself through good intentions and good nature, so that the consequence of that is good natured.
Sure. So there's a definite outworking of it that affects other things. So, yeah, so I gave a couple of other verses. And just to be clear, a lot of the other verses I gave were New Testament post-Jesus. But what I wanted to show there, and I spoke through with these guys, was often when people use the language of yeast, leaven, they use it in a negative way. It's something that permeates everything. If you get some yeast in your flour, you can't get it out. It's just going to affect the whole lot. And it sort of weeds its way through the whole lot, and it causes the whole thing to grow. And actually Jesus said something else about yeast, didn't he? He said, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. It was the Pharisees, wasn't it? Yes. And what he's saying is there, their teaching will kind of get in and it will cause growth right throughout, but it may actually sour it. It may be negative. It may be dangerous, but it will just expand and it will grow. And then he says the kingdom of heaven is like a little bit of yeast that goes into a huge mass of flour. You won't get it out, and it will grow, and it will be growth that starts from the inside and out, and it will be undramatic at first, but it will bubble away and bubble away, and it will spread, and it will grow, and it will be unlike the yeast of the Pharisees, I think. So Jesus sees his kingdom as being almost like a counter kingdom to the rule of the Pharisees there. Yeah. Great. I think just one... Oh, sorry, you go for it.
The way, you know, powerful, I don't know, it just kind of explodes, but the way God does things is not always like coming out with, you know, Africa, Denver, kind of thing. It's always kind of like,
not always the way you'd expect it, is it? If people were expecting some like enormous, this king arrives on the scene, takes everything over, that's what they weren't getting with Jesus. It was starting very small. And actually, it takes a long time for bread. I make bread every week, and you start it off, and then you have to leave it for an hour. And then you come back, and you have to leave it another hour. And like it's slow, and it's a bit tedious. And Jesus is like, you're expecting a kingdom where I just come in and just kick other people out. That's not what you're getting. You're getting something that's slow and steady, but it permeates the whole thing. And similar to the mustard seed thing. Start small. Don't get discouraged. It's going to grow. Yeah. Okay, third group. What was your parable and what do you make of it? Okay. What's it about? Hey! Yes, it's about the kingdom. Yeah, exactly. And what's Jesus' point with the metaphor? Kingdom of heaven is good. Yes. It's valuable, he says. Yes.
But that you wouldn't just like giving up a crossing,
Yeah.
But actually, he did this thing joyfully, so he was so happy to get to obtain the kingdom of God that he did what he did joyfully. It was kind of the kingdom of heaven isn't something you can just see, and then he saw the fire. He saw this thing in the field, right out there in the field, and then he picked it up, but that wasn't it. So, he did go and visit a nice house and think, that's great, but I'm not going to live there. He went away and sold everything he had so that he could live there so that he could experience it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the kingdom is something you have to experience. It kind of requires some kind of ownership. Of
yes.
Using of rather than just passively observing.
Great. So the kingdom, it starts off hidden, doesn't it? So it's hidden, you stumble across it, and then immediately, you can't just go, I'm going to steal that, or whatever. It requires you to do something, and it requires a big cost in order to take hold of the kingdom. But the recognition is that this thing is more valuable than anything else I have, and therefore I'm willing to give up everything else in order to take this. Now, do you reckon that someone hearing that for the first time would go, oh, wow, the kingdom is valuable? I don't think that's the shock for them. I think that people would have known the kingdom was valuable. They already knew that. That was what they were longing for. The shock for them is, hang on, I need to give up stuff to get hold of this? And that's where the sting in the tail comes. Because Jesus is saying, you're going to have to give up things if you want to get this kingdom. And I would suggest, we ought to move on, so I'll just suggest this quickly, but I think one of the things that Jesus was asking them to give up was their preconceived notions of what the kingdom would be like and how you would get it. And we looked last week at how the Pharisees and the Zealots and the Essenes had particular ideas of how the kingdom would come about. I think Jesus is saying something similar to the, you know, take up your cross and follow me. I think he's saying you need to surrender your ideas of what the kingdom is about and how you get hold of it. I'm going to tell you how it's going to come about. It's going to come by laying down your life, by changing everything, by giving up everything in order to inherit this kingdom. But it is so valuable and beautiful that it's worth it. So I think Jesus is again challenging people to give up their own kingdoms in order to take hold of his. Brilliant. Okay, we're pretty short on time, so I'm going to rush through. This is going to be the fastest telling of the wicked tenants you have ever heard, and I've ever done. And we may come back to this in the third term, actually, because in the third term I want to look at why Jesus got killed, basically, and I think this story is one of the reasons why why he got killed. He tells this story of the wicked tenants. Can someone read to me Mark 12, 1 to 12? Okay. Just thinking how to do this quickly. So, the danger of me doing this quickly is that it makes it look like I've read into this stuff things you could never find for yourself. And that's totally not the case. So that's why I'm pausing, just to say, if we had time and walked through this every step of the way, you would, I'm sure, come to many of the same conclusions that I have. So the fact that I'm going to rattle through this very fast now is not at all meant to make you think I could never do that. You totally could. We've just done it together. but here we go. I'm going to go fast. Okay, so when people heard this, I think they would have immediately have gone, oh, I recognize some of where this story is going. And the reason is because in the Old Testament, the theme of the vineyard was a very common one. And at the top there in the arrow, you can see a selection of verses, only a tiny selection, about the vineyard, where the vineyard is used as a particular metaphor. And the vineyard is often used as a metaphor for Israel, the people of God. And you can see that time and time and time throughout the Old Testament. But I think more than just going, oh, vineyard, I know what this story is about, they actually would have heard in here resonances of another story. They would have heard the story and thought, oh, that's familiar. That is a reworking of this particular tale in Isaiah chapter 5. So, could someone read to me Isaiah 5 verses 1 to 7? Yeah, that's right. Great. So there are similarities between these stories. And I think the hearers in Mark 12 would have heard this and thought, oh, he's telling the Isaiah 5 story, but with some major twists. So if we were to go through this, I would get you to look at these questions and answer them, but I'll answer them as we go through. Let's start with Isaiah 5. What is the vineyard in the story? Well, it tells us down towards the bottom, the vineyard of the Lord is the hosts the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel. So what is the vineyard? It is Israel. It's the people of God. Who are the inhabitants? Earlier on, inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judea. I think it's the people who make up the people of God. That's who the inhabitants are. Who is the owner? Easy one. God. Yes, well done. Who is the owner? God. What is the fruit he is looking for? Right down the bottom, he looked for justice. He looked for righteousness. This is what God is after from his vineyard. What is the crime? The crime is that they didn't deliver on the things that they were meant to produce. So when he looked for justice, he found bloodshed. When he looked for righteousness, he found an outcry. What is the consequence of their actions? He says, I will remove the vineyard's hedge and it shall be devoured. I shall break down its walls and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up, etc., etc. There'll be no rain. So the story is, God has made this vineyard, it's the people of Israel, he loves it, and he goes to an extent to say, I handcrafted this place, I dug out the rocks by hand, I made it beautiful. And when I looked for it to give good fruit, it gave bad fruit. So I looked for justice, I found bloodshed. What am I going to do? I'm going to punish it, I'm going to tear it apart. Yeah, that's Isaiah 5. People would have been familiar with that story. So then, Mark 12, what is the vineyard? I think it's the same. I think it's the people of God. Who are the tenants? I think they're the people who make up the people of God. Who is the owner? God. What is the fruit? Well, I think it's probably the same. It doesn't explicitly say, but I think you will probably assume it's the same. What is the crime? What's the crime in Mark 12? I think it's similar again. Bloodshed. Only specifically this time, it's bloodshed of all the messengers that God had sent to the vineyard. He sends one servant. They beat him. They send him away empty-handed. He sends another one. They struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent another one, and him they killed. So there's this bloodshed. And so with many others, some of whom they built, some of whom they killed, he keeps sending. God keeps sending messengers to his vineyard. There's an incredible amount of grace here. It's not just one-off. Hey, you beat my servant. How dare you get out? Again and again and again, God sends his servants. And you could ask, well, who do they represent? Are they the prophets? Is it Moses? Is it, you know, whatever. You could go through and think about it. We could tie it down to particular people if you wanted to, if you find that helpful. But I think the overriding point is God has given a ton of messengers and the people have rejected all of them. And so eventually God sends his son. And people hearing up to this point would have thought, yeah, I know this story. The son? What? And by the son, I think they would have known, as we saw in, I can't remember which week it was, last term, the son represents the Messiah, the son of God, the son of David, the son of man. So they would have thought, oh, sending the Messiah. And at this point, they might have thought, yes, we'd follow the Messiah. Of course we follow the Messiah. What do they do to the Messiah? They kill even the Messiah. And Jesus, of course, saying this to people, knows there are people here who want to kill me. And people are there who are thinking, I want to kill you. And so Jesus is calling them out, and people recognize that because at the end, they realize that he is talking about them. He's told the parable against them. What is the consequence? Again, it's destruction. But notice the difference between Mark 12 and Isaiah 5. In Isaiah 5, the vineyard gets destroyed. In Mark 12, it says, I will destroy the tenants. So there seems to be a judgment that comes upon the people as well as the whole structure. But the vineyard, what happens to the vineyard? Does the vineyard get utterly destroyed? No. Instead, it gets given over to different people. God doesn't destroy his vineyard. He doesn't give up on his purposes. Instead, he says, my purposes have been in the hands of people who don't deserve them and have rejected me and have killed my son. I'm not going to give up on my purposes, but I'm going to welcome in others. And that would have been a hugely challenging message for those who are hearing. Hang on, you are currently casting us as the people who are in charge of your vineyard, and you're saying that we deserve to be kicked out and other people brought in? That would have been hugely shocking for the Pharisees and for, in fact, all the Jewish people. Jesus wasn't, of course, saying you're all out, but he was giving them an opportunity to say whether they wanted to be in or not by responding to his kingdom message. And what is the hearer's response? Well, they wanted to arrest him. They weren't very happy with him. That is a challenging kick in the teeth from Jesus. Now, just one final thing to note on this, because at the end, you kind of think, oh, I've got that. And then he starts talking about a stone, and you think, what on earth is all of that about? Where is it? He says, have you not read this scripture? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. And you think, hang on, I got the vineyard bit. What's the stone bit about? So just very, very quickly, and again, I could take ages unpacking this, but Jesus seems to quote Psalm 118, which seems utterly irrelevant. And you think, where on earth does all this talk of stones come from? But again, if you were to go back to the Old Testament, you would find that the metaphor of stones is very, very frequent and very specific. In Isaiah 8, it says, and he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many shall stumble on it. They shall fall and be broken. They shall be snared and taken. And in fact, both Matthew and Luke, in their accounts of the same story, they allude to that. So Jesus seems to be saying, hey, you are getting offended by me. Don't you know that your own scriptures say you will be offended by this stone of offense and many of you will stumble on it? And so Jesus is saying, even God prophesied your response right now. The fact that you will find my words to be a stumbling block. Daniel 2, which we have looked at actually, a key passage about the kingdom. We get this mixed message about a stone that is not cut by human hands. It's divine in origin and it smashes all other kingdoms. And so the idea of the stone had become a picture of the Messiah, the Son of God who was coming to establish the kingdom. And Jesus says, I'm here, I'm the Messiah, but I'm not the one you were looking for. I'm actually a stone of offense to you. That's why you are stumbling over my words right now. He was saying things that he knew were challenging and that were going to get him into trouble. And even one just little nice hint to finish it off. In Hebrew, the word for stone is eben, and the word for son is ben. Very, very similar. They sounded the same when you said them. There's this kind of interchangeability of the sun and the stone. And Jesus is saying, I'm the sun and the stone. I'm the one that God has sent. And you're in danger of killing me. But God always knew you would. And the kingdom is going to be wider, open to far more people than you have ever imagined would ever come in and inhabit this good vineyard of God. And that's what got him killed. That and a number of other things as well. So there we go. Okay, I have worked you very hard. I'm sorry that I've talked a bit more than usual, and that may have been quite difficult. I don't know. I'm happy to stick around and answer questions at the end. You'll be pleased to know next week there'll be someone else teaching with me, so you'll only hear my voice for half of the time. But thanks for coming. Do ask questions if it would help. Otherwise, hope to see you next week. We'll be back in the auditorium. So there you go.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.